Accession number 8668, roll number 1.
Jackie Mulgridge, Reel 1. When did you first become interested in flying?
Well, I became interested in flying mostly as a sort of con to tell everybody that I was so clever that I was going to be a pilot, really, and to make people imagine that I meant it. I decided to do a correspondence course, which at that time was from America, and I hadn't even been up in an aeroplane then. And we lived in a military town, Pretoria, in South Africa, and I think it was called the Royal South African Air Force then. We were still British. And I used to take my bicycle when I was about 12, 13, 14, and cycle up to see the sunset on the top of the hill near the aerodrome. And I used to look at all the aeroplanes and think to myself, ah, aren't those people absolutely marvellous? Those pilots, those hands, fly those aeroplanes. I wonder how they... I'd never be able to do that. I'd be absolutely petrified. I'd never be able to do that. That was my first sort of thought about it. And that's really, I suppose, what gave me the idea that I would pretend I would do it, because to me it was the ultimate in the impossible, you know what I mean? And I think that's really what started it. I had no intentions of carrying it through. I didn't think I'd ever be capable of doing it, but I thought I'd pretend I would, because I was a very insignificant, timid little child. You know, not lonely, but on my own mostly, and I dreamt a lot.
Had you heard of any other women pilots at that time?
No, I didn't at that time, but when I went to the airport, my mother suggested I'd go and have a flight. And I met what was the first woman commercial pilot, and I thought she was absolutely marvellous. And she was pretty, and she was tall and slim and everything, and young, but of course, I don't know how old, you know, I can't remember. And I thought at that time that I could never do that sort of thing like her, that she, you know, that she could. I thought she was, to me, the most perfect person you could imagine, like rather like an angel. And then I thought, I wish I could be like that. Of course, I wouldn't be able to, you know, I told myself never be able to, but I'd pretend. So I really dreamt my way into aviation. Wishful thinking.
How did you come to have your first flight, your first trip?
Well, Mother took me up one Sunday from school, and we had a first... I just went up in what was called a Dragon Rapide, which was a six-seater aeroplane with double wings, and very bumpy. I was absolutely petrified. I had this terrible insecure feeling. I was the sort of child who couldn't even climb a ladder. I was so timid. I wouldn't go in a rowing boat. I was so timid. I wouldn't cross a bridge if I had to look down. I couldn't possibly do any of those things. And I couldn't sort of go head over heels. And I never learned to swim because I was petrified of water. So, you know, it was going up like that, I really had to be brave. And I was so sick, and I realized then I'd never make a pilot, because I was so terrified. Anyhow, about a month later, my mother said, would you like to have a lesson? I'll let you have a lesson. They were giving trial lessons for £3 or something. So I didn't like to say no, having said I was going to try and be, you know, I was going to be a pilot when I grew up. So I had my first flight when I was 15. And I'd read all about it by this time. I'd done the course, you know, the written course. And it's very different doing it in actual practice. So, of course, when he let me hold the controls, we nearly did a slow roll because I was overcorrecting and overreacting, not knowing anything about it. And I was sick all over the poor chap, the examiner. And when we came down, he said to my mother, I'm afraid she'll never make a pilot. And so she said, well, I don't think there's much chance. But the moment he said that, I think that was the time I decided, if it kills me, I'm going to be a pilot. That was really that when he said, she'll never make a pilot, I thought, that's what he thinks. I jolly well show him. You know, terrified as I was, sick as I was. So I think really that was the day I decided it wasn't going to be just wishful thinking, but I was going to try and be a pilot.
Were there any lower age limits at that point for learning?
Well, the thing was, it was a flying club, and naturally they were out to get as much money as they can. And when my mother said, you know, do you, can she learn to fly? And he said, oh yes, she can learn to fly, but she won't be able to go solo until she's 17. So my mother said, oh well, that's no problem. She'll be 17 next month, you know, my mother. She used to say anything that suited her. So I started having a lesson every Sunday or whenever the weather was good enough. And gradually, although I thought I'd never ever feel safe, gradually I began to feel the air was just as solid as being on the earth. Now that sounds extraordinary, but it is. My first impression when I just went up for a flight was that I was hanging there, terrified, very insecure. But gradually it came upon me that this is just as solid as the ground. The sky is like solid, like a sailor thinks the sea is, you know. It felt solid. And I no longer started thinking of it as the sky and the air and insecure. And gradually it became part of me. I took a long time to learn because I'm that sort of person, you see. Some people learn very quickly because they're mechanically minded and they don't know what to do. I have to absorb the element. But once I absorb it, then I'm usually better than anyone else because I don't have to think about it, you see. It becomes part of me, rather like dancing. And I think in flying is rather like, it's an art really, rather than a mechanical thing. And I think as you learn to fly, the more you learn to fly, you absorb it like you absorb a new language. It becomes part of you. You don't think you put your stick to the right and the right wing goes down, etc. And I found, I did get an instructor's license, and I found when I was teaching people that although you were supposed to say all these things when you put the right wing down, I found that if I didn't say anything much and just said, imagine yourself with this, that you are an aeroplane and you're balanced on a pin's head, and you have to keep your balance by moving this little stick very, very gently and keep it as still as you can in the center, and just keep on moving it until you stay on that pin's head. And that's really what flying is, balancing and absorbing it so that you do it naturally like the birds. It's not something mechanical, I don't think.
How helpful had the correspondence course been?
Well, it helped me a lot because it told me all about engines, and I had to draw all the engines, and I knew about stresses and fabric. So when I went to the Aeronautical College, I'd known it all before, really, you know, just as well, because they weren't terribly good at teaching you there. They just left you with some books and they went off. And I found that I'd learnt a lot more from my year's correspondence course, because being young and eager and still at school, my brain, I suppose, was active enough to absorb it.
Being so young, I suppose you hadn't driven a car.
Oh, no, I didn't drive a car till after the war, and that was rather strange. One day we ferried a Spitfire to an airfield, and we were told it was so muddy everywhere that our CO said, on no account are you to taxi it to one of the muddy fields. You have to get out so that we are not responsible for the aeroplane. Once you've delivered it, tell them that today you won't be taxiing it. The pilot there has to taxi it. It's his responsibility, or it has to be towed. Well, I got out of the aeroplane, and the squadron leader chap who came to see me said, would you mind taking it down there? And I said, no, I'm not allowed to, but you know, you can. It's your responsibility, or it could be towed with a tractor. So he said, oh, all right then. He said, you get the car, you drive my car and come and pick me up, and I'll take it down to the field, because of course it could be 2 miles away. Anyhow, I said, well, can you tell me what to do with it? Because I've never driven a car before. And he thought that was the funniest thing out.
So you carried on. Did you gain your solo license in South Africa?
Yes, I got. I started learning to fly and decided that now that the earth began to feel a bit more solid, you know, perhaps I ought to try and do a parachute jump. And nobody except Sir Piri von Reinefeld at that time. He was the first man who'd done a parachute jump, and being the airport being 6,000 feet above sea level, he hit the ground at a great speed, and he'd broken his ankle and he was limping. So being a silly child, I got on my motorbike, which I then had, and drove up to the headquarters of the aviation at the Union Buildings in Pretoria and asked to see Sir Perry van Reyneveld. And they said, what for? And I said, it was very urgent, it was on flying business. And I think they were rather amused. They showed me straight to his office, which, of course, these days would be unheard of. And I explained what I wanted to do, because I had to have his permission to do a parachute jump. I haven't told my mother. And so he said, well, you know, of course, you have to have training, you have to have this and everything. And I said, oh, I'll get all that. So he gave me permission, but for one specific day and one specific time of day. So, of course, it was very difficult. I had to hire and convince my mother that I needed a parachute to keep me safe while I was learning, and she got me one. And then I had to find someone who'd take me up in the aeroplane so that I could jump out. And I had to persuade my mother that that would be the lesson that I would have that day, but she didn't know I was going to jump. And then the night before, the radio said the young South African girl tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock is going to jump out of Pretoria. And, of course, there were thousands of people there, and I wasn't sure that I was going to jump, really. It was only a tent, you know, I'd only thought about it and thought, well, I wasn't sure that I'd have the nerve. Anyhow, I had to then with all those people. And, of course, as Sir Perry van Reyneveld had said, I also broke my ankle. But afterwards they discovered it was because I only weighed 6 stone, and the parachute was a 28-foot one, which is normally used on these high-altitude areas where you land. And I think it went into a candle form because it was a terrible day, for pouring with rain. It had got wet, and my weight wasn't enough to keep it open. So nearer the ground, I just seemed to drop like a brick. They filmed it, so they know. They had a record of it.
Were you given any instruction?
Oh, no, no. I couldn't. I wrote to a man who was the only one who did it in South Africa, who had done a parachute jump. And he just ignored me, didn't bother to answer. So I thought, oh, well, I'm not going to say I didn't have. And nobody seemed to mind. And he did come and see me in the hospital afterwards, and he was a little bit shattered when he saw me because I did look rather childlike sitting there at 16. Anyway, that was it.
And what was your mother's reaction?
Well, my mother heard it on the radio before, and she said, oh, no, it's impossible. You can't do it. I won't let you. And I said, but, Mother, I have to now because it's been, you know, it's on there. And anyway, that made me more determined because she said I couldn't, or, you know. And I thought, well, I'll have to do it now if it kills me. So she wouldn't come and see me, though. She was terrified. Somehow or other, I talked her into it.
Have you ever wanted to jump again?
Well, I wanted to, but I've always been rather scared of breaking my ankle again, and I don't mind the jumping part. It's hitting the ground, and I thought, well, you know, that pain that you have with an ankle, it just isn't worth it, and might damage my future flying life, really.
You decided to try and have a career in flying.
Well, my mother asked the instructor whether he thought I would make a pilot. And she, again, this was after I'd had a few lessons, and he said, well, she's really too young for, she doesn't know, she has no sense of responsibility. And I don't honestly think I did the parachute jump before I actually went solo. And so he said, I don't really think I've got enough, trust in her to let her go solo, but I'll have a word with the chief instructor. So the chief instructor took me up, and fortunately, I did 2 decent landings, and he took the risk and sent me solo. And said, go around and land where I am, then just in the middle of the field he got at. And of course, another thing which was amazing, I didn't realise at the time, I did a circuit all on my own, came in and landed, and I landed just where he was, which is not easy to do, but at the time I didn't realise it was quite. He was so impressed, he sent me off again. So I then went and flew from Johannesburg to Pretoria and landed where I'd done the parachute jump at the flying club in Pretoria. They said, where have you come from? And I said, well, I'd just done my first solo, so I thought I'd come and see where I'd done the parachute jump. However, they sent me back hastily because I knew nothing about how to work the compasses or navigation or map reading. I just followed the, road.
How far was it? How far is that?
Only 36 miles. But
did you have to get clearance for flights?
No, they
like
didn't
that?
Do anything like that in those days. You just, well, I should have got. Of course, I was so ignorant, I didn't know. I went back and they said, "You've been a long time. Where have you been?" I said, "I went to Pretoria and landed." They said, "What? You're not allowed to do that on your first solo." So, anyway, they thought, "Oh, she's stupid, you know."
How did you feel flying solo?
Absolute. I couldn't believe it at first. I kept telling myself, "I'm not really here," and I kept expecting to hear his voice. Pilots will always tell you that. They always expect to hear the examiner's voice saying, you know, "Watch your wing, watch your," or the instructor's voice, I should say. Anyhow, it was really lovely. I think it hit me about the third time I went solo, really, because it had been sort of 2 or 3 weeks then I had to go up again. But they wouldn't let you go straight off for the first. They used to give you one or two landings before they'd let you go again. You know, for the
you
first
were still
few
very
hours.
Young.
Yes, but they didn't know that. And I remember landing once. I'd been playing hockey that afternoon and I went to have my lesson in my gym tunic. And somebody was complaining to the examiner that that child, who looks about 12, shouldn't be flying that airplane on her own. And he said, "Well, you know, she's all right." They'd never ever asked for birth certificate or anything like that. So obviously, you know, he didn't know. They wanted the money. They didn't care. As long as they got the money, they didn't really care who was flying it or not.
Did you have to take a test to get your license? Did you do that?
Well, I came to England to the Aeronautical College. He also told my mother that it was so silly, really, wasting money on a girl, because he said it's very expensive training. Because my mother said, you know, could she get her commercial license? And he said, "I shouldn't waste your money." He said, "First of all, it's a very expensive training. She'll find it very difficult to get a job. Nobody wants a woman. And quite honestly, the salary just doesn't justify it. So I shouldn't, you know, bother if I were you." And so I said to my mother, "Well, in that case, I'm going to go and commit suicide because I don't want to be anything else." So she said, "Oh, don't be silly. It's only one man's opinion. You know, we'll see." And bless her heart, my mother, she decided to let me come.
But were many girls learning to fly?
No, except this one who had her license. I didn't see any others at all. There may have been a few at the time, but I never actually saw them. I only went up there once, you know, and did my lesson and came away. I was too shy to go into the club and take part in everything. I was just a little girl, really.
So when you left school, you applied to come to England to do...
Well, my mother decided that I'd have to have a... You know, I'd have to do it properly because I wrote all... I used to get Flight magazine and all the magazines have something to do with flying, and I saw all these aeronautical colleges and things. So I wrote to Cranwell, of course, in my ignorance, not realising it was Royal Air Force, nothing to do with... And they wrote back very nicely and said, "Unfortunately, you can't, unless you're a boy, you can't learn, you can't join Cranwell. We don't have women pilots or train them." So that finished that. So then we wrote to all the aeronautical colleges advertised, and the only one that accepted me was Whitney Aeronautical College, Oxford. And they really just wanted the money, you know.
How long a course was it?
Well, it was going to be 2 years. But I'd only done not quite a year, you know. Yes, I'd done about a year when war broke out.
So you came over to England, to the college.
Yes.
Were there other women learning?
No, when I got to England, the Aeronautical College was on the airfield itself. And the first night we arrived in there, they were having a cocktail party. Well, of course, I'd never had a drink in my life, you know. And I heard, and I'm being a South African, I heard this very cultured voice behind me. When I turned round, it was a Nigerian. And he'd obviously been to Oxford, or he was at Oxford at the time, with this very cultured voice. And I couldn't believe it, because before I actually... Well, as I heard him speak, I shouldn't say this, really. I could smell him, you know, because they have a smell. He was a Negro. Very charming man, you know, very cultured. And I was shattered. I couldn't believe it, because I hadn't seen a cultured Negro in my life, you know. I'd only seen the ones in South Africa. So that was my first realization that here I was, second day in England, talking to a cultured, educated Negro. I was really shattered. You know, I couldn't believe it.
Had you considered the shock of leaving South Africa to come to England before?
Well, no, because I think, as I say, fortunately for me, I was a child that always... I could always dream. When I had nothing to do, I would dream, you know, what I was going to do and what I wasn't going to do. And funnily enough, one of... I know it's not pretty irrelevant, but one of the dreams was that we were fighting a war, and there were only a few of us, and we were dressed up in what they wear in pantomime, you know what kids are, sparkling, sequined uniform from head to toe. I must have seen it in one of the pantomimes. And I was one of those soldiers, and there were about 10 of us, and we were all soldiers fighting for Britain, and we were all pilots, and we were the special pilots of the royal family. And it's most extraordinary because it's almost like being in the ATA afterwards. And that was sort of my dreams, you know. I used to have these silly little dreams and think about them for hours, just sit when I've nothing to do. I used to sort of invent things like that, and gradually they all came true. Isn't it extraordinary?
Did you want to come to England, or was it?
Oh yes. We had. I went to an English school. I went to a convent first of all. I just hated it. I really hated it. The nuns were terribly strict, and I was a thoroughly spoiled little girl, and they didn't understand a loner like myself, you know. And so, in the end, I was sent to an ordinary English school, and I loved it. I absolutely adored school. I wasn't clever. I wasn't a bit clever. In fact, maths was my worst subject. And then I realised I wanted to fly, and I realised I needed maths. So I did a course on maths. I taught myself all the difficult things, you know, that I had to know. And then I was all right, because I knew I wanted it for something. And English was my best subject, and we had an English teacher who had just come out from England. And he was really an inspiration. He introduced us to Jane Austen and all the... and Dickens and everything, and he gave us real English education. And he also used to tell us about England and say you knew when the first day of spring came, the whole atmosphere of everything changed. He described the autumn. And I felt I'd been there before, and when I came to England, I knew I'd been here before. I just felt it. I don't mean any psychic way, but probably all the things he told me. And of course, everything we read about in South Africa, all the books were English. I mean, there was no such thing as a South African writing about South Africa. We had the School Girls Weekly, which we bought every week. That was all about school in England and all about ambition and how they never, ever said no and how no matter what they got. And that was my inspiration. It sounds stupid now, but the School Girls Weekly, which has nothing to do with love stories and romance, was all about schools and being a schoolgirl, and you had your own study, quite different from the ordinary schools, and you were at boarding school, and no matter what happened, you succeeded in achieving what you wanted to do. And that was my dream. I was stupid, I was plain, I was ordinary, I was skinny, I didn't have any personality, and I was quiet, but I did read a lot, and that made me, that inspired me to want to do as those girls did. Yeah.
You say you're a flying instructor told your mother that money would be wasted as you were a girl.
Absolutely.
Was that a typical attitude towards girls?
There's no doubt about it, because it wasn't only then. Even in England you find that they say that. Even today they say that. When they're doing physics or maths, they say, well, they don't encourage the girls to do physics. My daughter, when I sent her, you know, the young one who's 23 now, when I sent her to a boys' public school to do her A-levels, I said I wanted her to do maths, physics and English, because those are the three subjects they needed for an aeronautical college, and I thought she might want to be a pilot and we might be able to afford to send her to one, you know. But she decided she didn't want to in the end. But at that time, no, they said, she'd never compete with the boys in maths, and she'd never compete with the boys in physics, and she would never succeed, and it was silly to take those two subjects. But I insisted, and I insisted, and I insisted, and she did them. And strangely enough, she passed, and a lot of the boys didn't, so they were very pleased with her, you see.
I think that is often the way,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
At the time when you were doing it, how did your friends react when you told them?
Well, they didn't believe me. Nobody believed me. It was a big joke.
This business of me going around with a book under my arm, you know, how to fly an aeroplane or aircraft engineering, I've still got those books now all over the house. I mean, none of them ever believed me. I mean, and the family, of course, thought it was a huge joke, that timid little thing. Oh, that's a laugh, you know, which only in a way increased my keenness, you know. I thought I must, if it kills me, I must be a pilot. I never thought I would be, you see. At the back of my mind, I had this feeling, of course, I'll never be able to do it. I never possibly could do it. I'm not good enough. I'll never be good enough. And I never feel I'm good enough, quite frankly. I always feel now, you know, that if there's a man anyway, I always give him the priority and say, well, you know, you fly it or you do it. Because I always have this feeling in the back of my mind that I'm not because I'm a woman, but mainly because I have this little bit of insecurity in myself that thinks I can't. And funnily enough, when I did the Royal Air Force Wings course, and there were 11 of us that passed out of about 120, and one of them was a professional pilot who joined the Air Force, and he was furious because he didn't pass. And I said to the examiner at the party, I wonder why I passed, because this other chap is a most marvellous pilot and he looks so good that he's not as terrified as I am. And, you know, he's so sure of himself. And the examiner said to me, a pilot that's so sure of himself is also a danger to himself because he's so overconfident that he'll kill himself if he flies anything fast. And we want pilots that are frightened, because if they're frightened, they're careful. So probably that's the only reason I got through.
When you came to Whitney at Oxford, did you say, were you the only girl learning?
I was the only girl learning to fly in the college. But of course they had, attached to it, they had a flying club. And there was Marigold Dean Drummond, who was also learning to fly, whom later I managed to get her into the ATA towards the end of the war.
And what about engineering?
There were two girls doing the engineering course. Funnily enough, one was a South African girl, and she resented horribly the fact that I was there. I don't know why, because, you know, she was a very pretty girl and very popular with the boys and everything. And anyway, she realised afterwards I wasn't a threat, because, you know. But the engineering student, she was doing it the hard way, and she borrowed an awful lot of money from little innocent me, saying that she'd pay me back, and she never ever did. And I met her when I was in the ATA at Hamble one day, and she was doing the engineering there. And by that time I'd realised what she was like, you know, that she used up an awful lot of my money that I had to have. And I was surprised to see that she'd got on quite well, but I felt very sorry for her, because I don't know whether she was an orphan, because she used to tell so many lies you never really knew what to believe. And just saw her, and she was an engineer. She